Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
Welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And welcome to our end of November. Is it November?
Yeah,
November, end of November episode where we'll be discussing the November Books and Boba book club pick, Empress of a Thousand Skies by Rhoda Beleza. And to help us with that, we brought in one of our guests, book club member and friend, Lily Rugo.
Hello.
Well, Lily is currently a what do we call you? Lily,
student, soon to be post grad, yeah. Former intern.
She runs a blog called This Bitch, where she talks about feminism and good stuff like that.
I also know that Lily is a K-pop fan. She kept me company during the whole BTS AMA performance, and yeah, it was. Lily's a good friend of ours.
And Lily's actually, Lily has actually worked for both of us. She worked under Rira when Rira was the editor of the collaboration blog. And she worked with me as an intern last year for collaboration. Mm-hmm. So
she actually came to our first book club meeting, even though
I did. I got a signed book from Sarah Kuhn.
Yeah.
That was when you were in town for the internship, right?
Yeah. But in town, I'm in Boston, they're in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Lily, why don't you share with us your background with reading and books? What kind of books do you like to read? What is your favorite Asian American or Asian author, if you have any? And
Well, I mean, I've always read ever since I was a kid. I've always been a big reader because my parents like introduced me to that. Harry Potter is, of course, one of the OG. I read The Magic Treehouse before that.
Yeah, Magic Treehouse.
Yeah, that was my jam. The Warrior series about cats, because I love cats more than most people. And that was great. That was a time. As far as like grown-up books, a lot of the things I've read have been for school, but they've been good. So like I've read Gatsby and stuff like that. I'm a huge Sherlock Holmes fan. A lot of these are white people books. I haven't read a whole lot of POC until, I guess, senior year of high school. Joylet Club was never required reading for the class, so I took it upon myself to read it, which was really good. I've read some other Amy Tan. And then after that, I started reading more Asian American authors. Crazy Rich Asians, of course. Else? I mean, this podcast is really helpful because I've been figuring out other really great authors. The Heroine Complex series has been great. But one of my favorite authors right now is probably Celeste Ng. Mm. I think about Everything I Never Told You still almost daily. Little Fires Everywhere was so good too.
Yeah,
and then,
really
Johnny Sun's book is also another one of my favorites. Just like,
that was a really good one.
Everyone's an alien, right? When you're an alien.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's but so alien cute. Spelled with a B.
Yeah, so Lily will be discussing the book with us. But first, let's review some of the latest book news, starting with new releases.
Okay, first on our list is Finding the Edge, My Life on the Ice by Karen Chen, published by HarperCollins, released on November 28th. At 17 years old, Karen Chen has already achieved what some girls only dream of. The daughter of Taiwanese immigrants, Chen began to figure skate at just 5 years old. 10 years and many grueling training sessions later, She broke out at the 2015 U.S. Championships with a bronze medal. In 2017, Karen became the U.S. national champion, winning gold in two programs and receiving the highest score ever recorded for the short program at the U.S. national level. For the first time, Chen shares the story of how she got where she is today and where she's going next. I'm a huge figure skating fan. I have a whole Tumblr dedicated to figure skating. So I'm very excited for the 2018 Winter Olympics, and Karen is a phenomenal skater. So I am very, very excited that this book is out. I'm probably going to go buy it pretty soon.
This is a biography.
It's a memoir. Uh-oh. And the foreword is written by Christy Yamaguchi. So nice. Yeah, definitely like legit cred.
I'm excited. It's been hard to root for the American team the last few years because A, Michelle Kwan isn't competing anymore, and B, Mirai Nagasa got robbed 4 years ago.
She's making a comeback though. She hasn't. I haven't really been keeping up with GPF this year, but we have Nathan Chen, and he won the Rustolicum Cup, so he's doing pretty well. And we also have the Shibutani siblings who are just dominating ice dancing.
Yes.
So, yeah, very excited for the American team, although I'm cheering for all of my favorites, despite which country
they're
coming
from. The main takeaway from this whole segment is that Rira,
figure skating is Rira's jam,
pretty much.
I watch the World Championships every year.
She even watches the animes.
Yuri on Ice.
Okay.
So good.
Okay, hang on. Do not, if you come for Yuri, I will fight you.
I've never watched it. I hear it's good.
Do it.
We were born to make history.
Next up is Ever the Brave by Aaron Summerall, published by HMH Books for Young Readers, releases on December 5th. After saving King Adrian with her newfound Chandler powers, Britta only wants to live a peaceful life in her childhood home. Unfortunately, saving the king has created a tether between them she cannot sever, no matter how much she would like to. And now he's insisting on making her a noble lady. And there are those who want to use Britta's power for evil designs. If Britta cannot find a way to harness her new magical ability, her life as well as her country may be lost. The stakes are higher than ever in the sequel to Ever the Hunted, as Britta struggles to protect her kingdom and her heart.
And our last book for new releases this month is Three Daughters of Eve by Elif Shafak, published by Bloomsbury USA, releases on December 5th. Peri, a married, wealthy, beautiful Turkish woman, is on her way to a dinner party at a seaside mansion in Istanbul when a beggar snatches her handbag. As she wrestles to get it back, a photograph falls to the ground, an old Polaroid of her with her two university friends and their professor. The book follows Peri as she reminisces about her friendship with Shirin, a charming and fully assimilated Iranian girl, and Mona, a devout Egyptian-American. Their arguments about Islam and feminism find focus in the charismatic but controversial Professor Azur, who teaches divinity but in unorthodox ways. This is our first Turkish book that we've mentioned on this podcast. It's definitely something that I want to read more of because I really don't know much about Central Asia.
You know, Turkey was the connector between Asia and Europe for the longest time through the Silk Road, right?
Yeah, I know that Elif Shafak, I'm not even sure if I'm saying it correctly. Elif Shafak, like the author that we just mentioned, she's like Turkey's like most popular female author. So she's actually very successful in her home country. It's the first time I'm hearing about her work in America.
Yeah.
But that just might be me and like my ignorance. So I'll definitely try to learn more about her work.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point of this podcast, is to learn about what's out there so you guys can go and explore. And, you know, even if you're reading books that isn't one of our book picks, please like discuss it on our forums. We'd love to learn more about stuff you're reading as well. That being said, before we move on to book news, don't forget that we have a Goodreads group where we hold discussions. There's been a lot more activity lately, a lot more people introducing themselves. If you're new to the group, please don't lurk. Please tell us who you are so we can welcome you into the group. It's been really great to see people just give their thoughts and discuss things that are happening. Mm. Yeah, and on that note, let's move on to book news. Little Brown acquired Nandini Bajpai's contemporary YA novel A Match Made in Mahendi The story follows an Indian-American teen girl who comes from a long line of matchmakers and decides to try to gain popularity in high school using her family's matchmaking traditions to create a dating app. Publication is scheduled for spring 2019. I feel like, why hasn't this already happened?
It sounds like a Bollywood movie. Next up is Simon & Schuster bought North American rights to 19-year-old Nadia Okamoto's nonfiction manifesto on the youth menstrual movement, Power to the Period. Currently a sophomore at Harvard, Okamoto is the founder of Period, the menstrual movement. The book is expected to show how young people can change the conversation around periods to support gender equality, ending poverty, intersectional feminism, and the environment.
Oh. Damn.
Yeah. End period shame. Okay.
Next up, Lee and Lowe is editing Roberto Penas's picture book, Pedro's Yo-Yos, How a Filipino Immigrant Came to America and Changed the World of Toys. The book is a biography of Pedro Flores, who popularized the yo-yo in the United States, and will be illustrated by Carl, I'm going to say Angel, but it could be Angel. Penas won the 2016 Lee and Lowe New Voices Award for the manuscript, which will be his debut. So congrats to Roberto.
Also, I did not know that Yo-Yo was popularized by, what's his name, Pedro Flores. Mm. Did not know.
They mean the little circular one on a string, right? Not the one with two sticks?
Yeah, the circular one on the string. Not like the fancy Chinese yo-yo that we've seen.
Yeah. That was a fun fact I picked up in high school. But I didn't know it was from Asia. Yeah. I just heard it was like a children's toy, or a weapon that has become modified, popular children's toy.
Wait, weapon?
I can see that. Like a morning star. Or like
okay, interesting.
Kind of. I don't know if it was used on people or like a hunting tool, but yeah, they would just kind of like throw it at their target and then it would come back.
There's that Chinese weapon that's just like a dart on a string, and like the way you fling it around is kind of like yo-yo tricks.
Okay. Next up is Mira Books acquired Mike Chen's debut novel Here and Now and Then, which tells the story of a man who races across time in order to raise and then save his only daughter before she is erased from history. The book is set for a 2018 publication. Sounds like The Time Traveler's Wife. It's reminiscent of it, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah, time travel is always an interesting premise.
Tough to pull off.
Next up, Knopf acquired Elizabeth Lim's YA debut, The Blood of Stars, and an untitled sequel pitched as Project Runway meets The Wrath and the Dawn. To provide for her family, 17-year-old Maya Tamarin disguises herself as a boy to compete for the position of Imperial Tailor. Her task to sew three magical gowns of the sun and moon and stars leads her to find adventure, romance, and danger in a Chinese-inspired fantasy set. In a Chinese-inspired fantasy setting along a reimagined Silk Road, publication is slated for May 2019.
And next on our list is HarperCollins acquired Cindy Lin's The 12, a debut Asian-inspired middle-grade fantasy. Pitched as Avatar The Last Airbender meets Harry Potter, the book follows 12-year-old Usagi as she teams up with rebels in hiding to hone her innate magical abilities and reunite a mythical group of warriors to save her island kingdom from tyrannical dragon lord. Publication will begin in summer 2019.
I love all these Asian-inspired fantasies coming out.
Oh my god, 2019 is going to be a magical year.
That Elizabeth Lim novel sounds kind of like Project Runway meets whatever that other book is, meets Mulan too. Speaking of Mulan, they casted Mulan.
Yeah.
I have so
many thoughts about that, but
same.
Well, yeah. There's a thread going on in our Goodreads forum, so
you'll hear my thoughts in the forums because I wrote a really long post.
Well, we can discuss more on there. But before we get to our book club discussion, we did want to talk a little bit about the major like incident that came up in the world of comic books this past week.
Yeah, so Marvel's new editor-in-chief, C.B. Sobolski, I don't know if it's Chobolski or Sebolski.
I mean, who knows how to pronounce these
names? Okay, well, I'm just going to call it Sobolski. he recently admitted that he wrote comics under the Japanese pseudonym of Akira Yoshida, 13 years ago for about a year. And
I mentioned this on my other podcast, the Collabcast, but that's like the same as naming your guy like John fake name.
John Smith. Yeah. Like Akita and Yoshida are very common names. So, yeah. But it's really messed up because one, he broke company policy because back then Marvel didn't allow their editors to write comics for the company because of corruption. But he decided to adopt a Japanese pseudonym and he also gave interviews as Akira Yoshida. So there are interviews of him like making this elaborate backstory about how he I have a quote.
It's a super crazy story.
Yeah, he tells journalists that he grew up in Japan reading manga and how he first learned English from his from American comic books that his dad would bring him from business trips. And that's really fucked up, man.
Yeah.
Also, it's really fucked up because Marvel and a lot of other comic book publishers, they were looking for a Japanese Japanese
looking for diverse.
Yeah, they were looking for own voices comic book writers, and he got hired as Akira Yoshida because they thought that he was Japanese, and therefore the stories that he was telling were authentic.
Yeah, and Reappropriate had this great thread going through some of his some of his stories that he wrote as Akira Yoshida, and involved Wolverine in Japan or Kitty Pryde in Japan. Or
he also wrote Elektra.
Yeah.
And that's that's really fucked up because a lot of the characters and the setting, it's set
very
in Japan.
Oriental,
it's
very
Japanese inspired, but it's not, it's honor.
Yeah, she dug into the storylines. It's a lot of talking about honor and sacrifice, and this is how we do it. This is how we honor.
And the thing that really disturbs me is that Marvel knew about this for a number of years because Cebulski came forward and told them about his pen name, and they just quietly let Akira Yoshida kind of die.
Well, there's two things, right? There's that Marvel knew about it, and even when they didn't know about it, they used the fact that this supposedly real Japanese person is writing these stories about samurai honor and Bushido, whatever. Obviously, it's authentic, so we're going to publish it. Mm-hmm. And it's
because that publishing has institutional racism. There can only be one Asian comic book writer, right? So I just think about how many jobs that Asian American creators were turned away because of C.B. Cebulski. And it's what a way to start your editor-in-chief career, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if he's still going to stay in that position after all of this.
He shouldn't, though.
But Marvel still promoted him, even though they knew that he went through this crap. And, fair point. He has family in Japan, and he's kind of, lived in Japan on and off. But that doesn't mean that he's Japanese, and he's definitely not Japanese-American. It's...
Mm-hmm.
And, I remember, a couple years ago, there was this white poet who went by a Chinese name.
Yeah, and he got into an anthology, won an award.
Yeah.
Because people thought he was Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
It's just these white authors, they think that they can just cherry pick from a culture and just... It's really frustrating because a lot of Asian and Asian American creators, we have to change our names in order to be more marketable. And it's that's a really agonizing process for us because it's you're just I like my name, it's beautiful in my culture, but I have to change it to something that's phonetically similar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's such a there's another guy that does this too. He writes
David Wong.
Yeah.
I knew you were gonna mention him.
And the first time I saw, the editor in chief of Cracked is David Wong, and then I looked him up. It's this is a white dude. This is a pseudonym.
I don't think he's ever given interviews as an Asian person, though. I will give him that.
But at the same time, we're at a time when we're so hungry for representation, especially 13 years ago,
It was really racist back then. Yeah. At least they couldn't get an actual Asian person to tell those racist stuff. It's mind-boggling.
This type of thing shouldn't have been okay back then. Definitely isn't okay now. And I guess we'll end this with there's been a hashtag movement to actually call bring light to actual Asian comic writers called hashtag actual Asian comics writers.
We actually recommended some comics through that hashtag.
Yeah.
And so did a whole bunch of people. And, you know, I do want to say that, like, comics isn't restricted to superhero genres. Like, it's definitely a much wider medium than most people think. I mean, manga is considered comics. And we read Monstrous for this book club. And and that's not really superheroes either. Yeah. So,
or Tibui's The Best We Could Do.
Yeah, which was a graphic memoir. So definitely check some of the recommendations out, because I think people have done a really good job compiling recommendations.
Yeah. Anyways,
we're going to take a break and then go into book discussion.
There is a thread ongoing on our Goodreads forum. So if you want to sound off on this, feel free. We'll see you there. But yeah, when we come back, we're going to talk about our November book club pick. All right, Rira, Lily, you guys ready to go to the stars?
Am I reading the book jacket description, or are we just going to jump right into it?
Tell us, let's start us off. What is Empress of a Thousand Skies by Rhoda Beleza about?
The only surviving heir to an ancient Kalusian dynasty, Rhi has spent her life training to destroy the people who killed her family. Now on the eve of her coronation, the time has finally come for Rhi to claim her throne and her revenge. Alyosha is a Raitan who has risen above his war refugee origins to find fame as the dashing star of a drone vision show. Despite his popularity, Ali struggles with anti-Raitan prejudices and pressure of being perfect in the public eye. Their paths collide with one brutal act of violence. Rhi is attacked, barely escaping with her life. Ali is blamed for her presumed murder. The princess and her accused killer are forced to go into hiding, even as a war between planets is waged in Rhi's name. But soon Rhi and Ali discover that the assassination attempt is just one part of a sinister plot. Bound together by an evil that only they can stop, the two fugitives must join forces to save the galaxy.
Yeah. So, starting off, what are your, I guess, initial thoughts about the book?
I will let Lily start, since she is our guest.
It was good. I was never, like, I wanted to finish it. I was never bored, but I never feel, like, I don't feel compelled of, like, oh my god, what's going to happen next? I need the sequel right now. I thought the author did a really good job of kind of expanding on it. A lot of these sci-fi space stories will be, like, set across the galaxy, but there's actually two planets. I thought she did a really good job of actually detailing space and the way they travel and stuff like that, and describing different aliens. There were some furry ones, there were some slimy ones. They're not all just like roughly human based, so I thought she did a good job with that. But like overall, it was aight. It was fun.
It was aight.
I liked it a lot. I thought the main characters were kind of jerks, but I liked the story. The main characters, they were written as like selfish, to be honest, right?
Yeah.
So it was kind of fun to read and see the story like unfold, this like this galactic conspiracy slash like space opera, while also like having these characters get punished for their stupidity every single chapter. Actually, one of our book club members, Erica, posted on Goodreads how she was really appreciated the portrayal of space racism in the book, as not only between species, but also between human factions as well.
Yeah, it was like really nice to see people of color in space, because I feel like we don't see that a lot. And it was nice that not only racism was present in the story, but also colorism, because there are like little scenes where like a character is told, don't go out into the sun because your skin's going to get darker. And that's like considered a bad thing.
Yeah. And this is not to say that space racism is good. We're just glad it's addressed.
Yeah.
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 I mean, I was very surprised how timely some of the themes were in this book.
Yeah.
It was really freaky, and I had to like check when this book was published. It was published earlier this year, and I was like,
I mean, shitty people doing shitty things to gain power and to
there were like specific things that I was just like, damn. There were like specific things in this book where I was like, oh man, this could have been pulled from a Donald Trump speech, and it was a little bit jarring. But I really liked the intergalactic policies, and not policies, like the politics of it, and like just how each planet and each territory had their own culture and their own way of like communicating. And the technology in the book was also like really intriguing. I mean, the book overall reminded me a lot of Star Wars, where there's like multiple characters and they're kind of doing their own thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And with the whole like Space Zeppelin, it kind of reminded me of Galaxy 999, although in Galaxy 999, that's a train. It's a space train. But yeah, it definitely reminded me a lot of other sci-fi works.
Probably a lot of work was put in by Rhoda to build this galaxy, right? Because she has like, and she has a map in the beginning of the book.
Oh, thank God. There was a map.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Oh, my God.
But yeah, like, it's every planet, every setting had its own distinct character, and she was able to convey that in very succinctly too. Where should we start? Should we start with because basically the way this novel is set is two narratives that switch off.
I wanted to ask you guys on your opinion on the dual perspectives. Like, were you a fan of that, or was it like hard to pay attention to the story, or was it something that made the story more interesting?
It was really hard not to skip every other chapter sometimes.
Whose POV did you prefer more?
I liked Alyosha's.
Me too. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
Because Reese was just kind of like, Alyosha was more like of a swashbuckling adventure through the stars, and Reese was like man on fire but bad. Like, not bad as in like a bad, like not good overall, but like she's just really bad at her job.
It was just really funny because all of the people that Princess Rhee runs into, they tell her, you're spoiled, you're sheltered, you're entitled, mm-hmm. and you think that you're this badass like assassin, but you're really bad at this. And she's like, mm-hmm. no, I'm not. I might be young, but
I've been training my whole life for this moment.
Yeah, yeah. But then like she fails so many times. And I actually really like that, even though I got annoyed at her making these mistakes. But it's like, oh, it's nice that you have a protagonist who's making really stupid choices and she's facing a lot of consequences for it.
Yeah. And this
also,
is not to say I didn't.
She is 16, so there are a lot of like YA or like 16 teenage protagonists who are like able to do all of their goals with somehow. So it is nice to see that, like, oh yeah, 16-year-olds mess up a lot.
That's something that I kind of forget sometimes when reading YA, is like the characters are typically teenagers.
Yeah. I mean, I also like, my pet peeve is when teenagers are written as if they're like old souls.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I listen to 80s music and I'm like I'm like a 40-year-old at heart. And I'm like, that's not what teenagers Junos, right? like, and that's not how they act. So it was really nice that you have a protagonist who's like so imperfect and so single-minded in one thing, and kind of like is so impulsive that she just kind of charges in without really assessing the situation. And I think there's a growth to her character by the end of the book. I mean, it was a very frustrating journey. But
Well, I think at the end, and we're skipping around a little bit, but in the end, it sets her up as kind of a, like, I wonder where she's going to take this into the next book. And I bought the soft cover version of the book, which came out this month. And there was a preview for the next book at the end. And it seems like they're taking her, like, she is taking the Cersei route of, like, I'm going to play this game now. Like, yeah. Now that I know the rules, I'm going to play the game and like win from like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Lily? Like, did you like the dual POVs? Is there one that you preferred more over the other?
I thought I did prefer Allie's, but neither of their narratives were like so on the edge of my seat that I thought it was like a jarring switch. I would just be like, oh, okay, now we're switching over to this dude, or like back to her. Kind of talking about the character stuff, she was, yeah, you could always tell she was 16-year-old. Allie, I kind of forget how old he's supposed to be. He's what, like 18, 19-ish?
I think he's probably closer to 20 than...
Yeah, probably closer to young adult age.
Yeah, and like he was still pretty immature, but he also like, he's seen some shit in his life, and he was not as like annoyingly old soul as like what you're talking about, Rira, but you could tell that like he was drawing on some stuff shit. That he...
Yeah. I mean, from his perspective, yeah. We kind of see the refugee or immigrant struggle, right? The like his whole character is about like just putting your head down. And even his like mm-hmm. his arc. So Alyosha is he's a private in the collusion
Uniforce
army. He's stationed on a, I guess, outer rim patrol ship with his comrade
buddy
Vincent.
And they inadvertently become reality TV stars.
I thought that was a really nice touch, because there are so many.
I just figured like they're the equivalent of YouTubers, right? They're like,
no, they're like the real. They're like cops.
Yeah, they're like cops.
Yeah. Oh. okay, that makes
sense. But it's just like so funny to me that like they are these reality stars, and the production team has to like create like fake chase scenes for them because their job is so boring that there's nothing happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then like in all sense, like Allie is a black character. He is dark skinned, he's from a planet that people view as savage. And like not war, like they're second class citizens pretty much. He's paired with his partner is basically the equivalent of, I don't think it's white, more like maybe, how did you read the collusion?
I thought he was white. I don't know if like his eye color was mentioned. I think Vincent might have had blue eyes, and
I figured the collusions were mostly like European Western.
But then
that's
like
tan too. So I kind of read it maybe
because like Rhea is described to have like tan skin, and I'm guessing that she's more like Filipino in appearance, right? So it's hard to tell. I just know that Vincent has privilege.
Yeah,
and like it's really funny because I wrote down a quote that Ali says, and he says this is him describing Vincent. He did whatever he wanted because people had always let him.
Yeah.
So and I'm like, oh, that's just white privilege, just in a sentence. Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And then but if you think about it, this is a reality TV show about a interracial cop partnership.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really like, I don't know. It's, but, and because of that, like, he is burdened with the rep sweats pretty much.
Yeah, because like people find out that he's part Raten, and and they're like, oh, that's not okay. And I think Allie is kind of like burdened with like model minorities, like, oh, I need to be like the perfect,
I need to represent, like I need to show everyone else that my people aren't that bad.
And I need to also show my people that they can get to, like, can get this far, which makes this whole arc more tragic.
Yeah. Should we focus on one arc at a time, or should we? Like...
I think we should just jump around wherever we feel like.
Space.
I mean, the general story is, Princess Rhi is on her way back to be coronated. It's an early coronation spurred by the ambassador Nero.
She has to be coordinated because all of the senior members of the royal family were killed in the mass assassination attempt.
Her family died in what they're calling an accident.
Yeah, they were leaving their planet, yeah. And she wasn't sure like what they were,
yeah,
why they were leaving. But like when she was younger, she knew that they were fleeing from their planet, yeah, for a reason.
And she was left behind, and then her family like space car blew up.
Yeah.
Spaceship blew up.
And for all these years, Rhee thought that the regent of Kalu was responsible, yeah, for arranging the murder
her
of father's
her best friend. Because, so like in the background of this whole story is this peace treaty, right, that Kalu signed with Fontis.
Yeah, Fontis.
Which is a planet of what I assume to be space elves.
Oh my god, right? I had the same exact... I wrote space elves in my notes. Space elves with tattoos.
Who fly flying trees. So it was an unpopular treaty because Kalu was already on the path to victory. Like, they would have won and wiped out Fontis, but the Rhee's father wanted peace.
Yeah, like, because Rhee's father knew that not making the treaty would extend the war, extend casualties, and possibly have a genocide on his hands. And that's something that no politician wants under, like...
Yeah. And so Rhee remembers that Setra, her father's best friend, was warning him, like... Half the galaxy wants you dead.
Yeah.
Right. And she believes that was him threatening her father, right? Mm. Based on her memories, memory plays a huge role in this story. Like,
yeah. Why don't we talk about that? Because I think it's a huge important to the plot.
Yeah. So in this world, they have cubes. They call it cubes, which is basically a. Basically a implant that records memories. It's how you connect to the internet.
It's pretty much our phones in a chip
your
form.
Neck.
Yeah.
It's like on the back of your neck.
And it comes with Google Translate. It comes with Google Maps. It comes with Picasa and YouTube and Twitch all built in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the cubes, not everyone has them, but most people have them. Most people in the inner circle of planets. Yeah. The outer planets don't really have cubes, but
So they are luxury smartphones.
Luxury smartphones that you're always plugged into.
I wouldn't even say luxury. I think they try to make them pretty available.
Yeah, pretty available. Yeah.
So just smartphones.
Yeah, and so. There's a subplot of this story about the ethics of if you have this thing that can basically store memories, how do you ethically advance that technology? Because they talk about so how do we do person-to-person transfer? How do we do communications? How do we do retrieval of memories? Yeah. And should we do retrieval of memories?
Also, it brings to mind that there are a lot of people with these cubes who are constantly revisiting good memories and not living in the present.
Yeah.
And also it seemed like the cube kind of blocked your senses, because you're so focused on something that's not happening to you in real life that you can't really hear what's going on in real life, and you can't really smell things, and it really just turns people off from the real world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And people, a huge point of this, especially Rhee's arc, is her, by living in this, by replaying this moment over and over again in her head, she's developed her own belief structure based on this one incident. And that kind of informs her entire, her
arc,
goal,
personality.
Yeah, and it's interesting when she's, when she turns off her cube and she's going on her journey, all these old memories are popping up, and they're memories that she never really visited in her cube. And she's pulling out new details, right?
Yeah.
Details about her sister. When she used to revisit her memories through the cube, she kind of saw her sister as a perfect sister who had everything together and was very kind to her. But then when she actually thinks back on it through natural memories, she's oh no, my sister was a hard bitch who had tough love, and we used to fight all the time. And she And it's like really interesting because it's kind of like the cube has kind of like an Instagram filter for memories. You only pay attention to the stuff that you want to pay attention to.
Right. And that's a good point. Like both Ree and Allie have to turn off their cubes because they
tracking.
Yeah, because they can also be tracked by it. They can be identified by it. So I think even in the first few chapters, basically Ree is on the run because she just escaped an assassination attempt. And Allie is on the run because people think that he killed her.
I guess we can go into more of the plot, I guess.
So one of the more frustrating things about the story is the book jacket makes it seem like they meet up at some point and team up, but they never do.
It's a duology, so I'm guessing that they do meet up in the second book. But yeah, I thought that too. I was like,
well, they meet up for like one scene.
I thought like halfway through the book, I was like, are they ever gonna meet? And I just gave up on that thought. I was like, I don't think they're ever gonna meet. And that just made a much more pleasant reading experience for me. Because I didn't have this false hope that they were going to like meet and like have like and like team up together. I actually preferred that there were two separate stories because I don't know, it kept me more engaged, I guess.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah. As soon as the second mystery girl was introduced in Allie's arc, I was like, oh wait, they're not going to interact. Like the two main leads aren't going to interact at all.
I totally knew that was her sister.
Yeah. There's a lot of like very predictable twists in this book, but it doesn't mean that it's bad. Yeah. It's just like this, like
how the ambassador, like I knew, like I had a feeling he wasn't, the bad guy, and seeing her like really fuck that up was kind of like,
yeah. Like, what did you think about her meeting Dalin, the Fontesian monk that helps her?
You mean like the murder monk?
The murder monk.
The murder elf,
ridiculously violent monk.
Yeah, like the murder elf with like fire powers.
He doesn't have fire powers.
He burned the guy to like a.
He has a ring. I don't think it's him.
Yeah, I don't think it's like him. I think it's a piece of weapon, but
I don't know.
Because you're kind of introduced to him as like this person who saves Ree from getting killed by Veyron, her longtime companion and protector, and. You think that he's like a good guy for the most part, right? Because he like helps her and he like offers her a way to disguise herself and he like hides her from the Uniforce officers. But he kind not betrays her, but he has his own revenge agenda, plan.
But at the same time, she didn't really trust him anyways, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, like I thought it was interesting that like he was so mission focused, but he was like, oh sure, we'll take this detour so you can murder your target because it's also his target.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, was he supposed to be like the foil so Ree can look at like his ruthlessness and be like, oh wait, I don't want to get that bad.
No, I think he's like the main lover.
No, I don't think they have Ree was obsessed with Julian. Like from beginning,
Julian's the hometown guy. They're setting up a love triangle. This is a YA book, right? They're setting up the love triangle.
not all YA books have love triangles. They subvert.
No, honestly, I thought Allie was going to be in a love triangle between the sisters, and I was like, this is interesting.
That's the other love triangle that will form.
No, I don't.
It will
think
be
so.
Dual love triangles.
No, it's Ree, the elf, and Julian. But it's going to be. I think it's going to be Julian.
I don't know. Kind of a punk.
We haven't seen enough of him to know.
Yeah, he exists.
But it was.
I love how we're just like so jaded with YA.
I'm not jaded, okay? I trust the author, who's also an editor, by the way. I think she knows her tropes and knows how to skirt around that.
I did enjoy the earned romance for Allie at the end. But yeah, anyways.
Yeah. With Dalin, he's a Fontesian monk, and I thought that was really interesting because, like, Fontes, the planet, they seem to practice one religion.
Yeah, so...
Like, they worship one god, which is kind of reminiscent of Christianity.
And Kalu practices something more similar to, like, East Asian religion, which is Ancestor and paying respects to ancestors. Yeah.
Yeah. That was interesting because, like, normally when we look back in history, like, people with multiple gods are, like, kind of condemned, right? It's like, oh, there's only one god, and you have it all wrong. But then in this book, it kind of flips it, where it's like, oh, you only worship one god? That's kind of messed up. And they have a slang for Fontesians. And Fontesians also don't use cubes because of religious practice. So that's also, like, an interesting aspect, because most of the galaxy use cubes.
Yeah, but it's also weird that they still had them installed. Like,
that was set weird up too.
Like, cubes weren't a voluntary thing, or like you sign up to be a monk, but other Fontesians kind of use them low key. Because I kind of realized, like, wait, why does he have one then?
I guess, like, when they do decide to join a monastery, they make a vow to turn them off forever.
It's like the no sex law, except it's no cubes.
No cubes. Imagine if that was, like, in real life. It's like, oh, you want to be a priest? You can't have a smartphone.
Give us your iPhone.
You can't use the internet for the rest of your life.
I mean, isn't that, there are religions like that, though.
So let's talk about Ali being framed for a murder that he didn't commit and how the world kind of reacted to it.
I mean, he's framed because he was a scapegoat. He's like a prominent...
He was a convenient scapegoat because he finds the escape pod that Veyron was in. And yeah. Veyron is Rhi's companion who she killed because he betrayed her. And he sent out a signal being like, hey, like, I need help. I just found a dead body in space.
Yeah.
He
was convenient also because the big bad, the main bad guy, who I guess we can say Nero, who is the ambassador. He's like the PR guy, right?
PR guy, press secretary, press manager.
Who turns out to be like a crazy dictator guy who's doing secret experiments, and he wants something on Rheta, which is Ali's homeworld that got pretty much like nuked to hell.
Yeah, they got nuked to hell.
Yeah.
And like the planet is completely destroyed.
Yeah.
And
if you look at the map that Rhoda drew, it's like just pebbles. It's like...
Yeah.
Rheta is interesting because it's where the cubes were actually manufactured because they had the material to build them.
It's a working class manufacturing like world.
And it says something about colonialism, right? It's just like, oh, this planet has a thing that we want.
Yeah.
So let's like pretty much do shit to this planet and control it.
Yeah.
So Ali is from that planet, and because the main bad guy wants to invade that planet, Ali makes a very convenient scapegoat. Like, look, those guys are still bad. Let's go invade them. Mm-hmm. I really liked... I ended up really liking Vin during the adventure. Because he's like... He is portrayed as, you know, like your classic rich boy with privilege. But it turns out that he's also
a spy for the United Planets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like he's fighting the good fight. He's like part of the resistance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he really does keep Ali alive.
Like, yeah.
He saves his butt. Yeah. You know? And then halfway through the story, he dies.
He dies.
I did not see that coming. I thought Vin was going to stick around.
Yeah.
And then he didn't. So.
Because Ali pulled a Rhi and was a dumbass.
Yeah, he pretty much got into a fight when it was the worst time to get into a fight.
Like he
I would say that like that entire accident is equal to you not looking at the road because you're like looking at your phone and then you like crash into a truck. That's pretty much what happened in space terms.
And then only after Vin dies does Ali realize that like, man, he was a good friend.
I mean, isn't that I mean, you don't know what you had until you lose it.
I thought that was that was a bummer.
Going back to Rhi, though, so she wants to get revenge on Syetra, and she gets a mark because she refuses to take the DNA pill. And I've read a lot of reviews where people were really infuriated by that because they were like, why didn't she just fucking take the DNA pill? Like, it would have saved her so much trouble. And
I mean, I got it. Her identity is like all, like her identity as the last Tan princess.
I mean, like, she's known Dalin for like how many minutes? Like 30 minutes? Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, take this medicine that's going to change everything about you.
Yeah.
It's like, of course you're not going to, you're going to have some hesitation.
Yeah.
But she gets a mark, and it's really unclear to me whether that's permanent or if
it wears off.
Fades. Oh, yeah. Wears off. Okay. But
she's got like a really bad bruise, I think.
Well, it's just like I think it's like I imagine it like really bad eczema or like a big rash, kind of like tumors. Not the tumor, but like I imagine it'd be like a really bad like
purple. But she goes to kill Syetra at her own funeral, right? Because everybody thinks that she's dead.
But then she starts to doubt her memory because since she turned her cube off, she's been noticing other like signifiers. But then that's when Dalin swoops in and murders him anyways. And then she's like, basically this throws her into like a shame spiral, right? Because she suddenly starts to doubt that Syetra was bad and realize that he's the only person who has all the answers, that he was actually like trying to protect them. Like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And now she doesn't have him anymore because he got blown up.
I do want to talk more about Nero, who turns out to be the real quote unquote villain.
Yeah.
Cause like he's kind of introduced as this suave guy with like good looks.
He's the Stanley Tucci guy from Hunger Games.
I think he's more like Ryan Seacrest of like hosting like a show.
Yeah, I was so confused at how he got political power because I thought he was
He's the ambassador. He's the ambassador to
The regent got killed, so he's the next in line. I think
that's a terrible system of power.
I mean,
he was always a government official. He was an ambassador. He's pretty much like
he's had a TV show.
No, the TV show is part of his. He's like the press secretary.
He's like press secretary and also like secretary of state.
Yeah, he's definitely he is like a head diplomat though. He's definitely like second or third in command of the government.
Oh,
but like for a good like a quarter of the book, Rhi decides to like go find Nero because she thinks that he can help her.
Yeah,
and she like goes into like a press event or what are they called?
Press junket.
Oh, press junket.
Yeah.
And that's when she notices that he's wearing like his military
uniform.
Military uniform. Yep. And he's saying things like, oh, our immigration laws have been too lax and Raytons are dangerous and they're draining our resources.
His exact slogan is take back what's ours.
I know. When I read that, I like freaked out. I was like, oh my God. Like, I'm pretty sure Rhoda Beleza wrote this before 2016 and it's really creepy.
And then he says something. He claims that, oh yeah, all the escape pods are accounted for, which tips her off that like, oh, he's like, he's lying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was like a woman in the crowd who like asks him like, oh, this isn't defense. This is like you attacking other planets. You're breaking the treaty. And they just throw that woman out of the press junket. And it's really scary because we're going back to the cubes and how like the government can manipulate information.
Yeah.
Because like you find out that there's an overwriter where like,
well, okay, so this is the center of Nero's like evil plan is he doesn't want like to just rule over Kalu. He wants to control everybody, right? And
he's playing the long game.
Yeah, and the overwriter is pretty much like it's a thing that allows you to essentially like overwrite a person's memories and personality.
Yeah,
right? And like. What's really important is that there is this summit, like the summit of scientists, and they've had the overwriter be like a couple of years ago, and they decided that this is illegal. This like breaks so many moral ethics. We can't use this, but the government has been secretly using it.
No.
Or wait, no, have no. they been using it? No, the yeah, text is there, but it's on RADA.
It's
or the no, remains of RADA, no, and that's what they're.
Everything is. It's. It was brought up as theory.
Okay, it's brought up as theory, but
It was built. One was built by Lydia.
Okay, yeah, because like Lydia uses it on Kara.
On Kara. That's the only time it's ever been used.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about ravaging, which is another thing. Ravaging is like hacking.
Ravaging is retrieving memory. So like remember a big part of like the meta narrative here is the ethics of a piece of tech that can affect memories. And in turn, because they can affect memories, it can also affect personalities and basically what is a soul if it's not just like your memories and personality, right?
Yeah.
And that was presented as a lot of theory, but then you through Ali's story, you start to realize that no, like they've been doing it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because so while Rhee is going on her like misadventures of bad assassins, of bad assassinations, Ali is basically uncovering the conspiracy that's at the heart of Nero's plot.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which is Nero wants the Overrider. He basically knows that it exists, so he's kidnapping every single scientist that was at the like G1000 summit, ravaging their memories in search for where it is.
And the and his strategy for doing it is kind of like it's kind of similar to our world where like something really like political happens, but they want to distract the masses with like a sensational news story, right? So in this case it's like Ali is the news story. It's like oh like he murdered the princess when clearly he didn't, and people are gobbling it up. And because they're like so obsessed with that part of the news, they're not paying attention to martial law and to all of the all of the riots and also like things that the Kalu not empire, but like things that
I think Kalu, it's empire. She's empress.
I guess like the Kalu empire is like breaking all of these. Like
and
violating the treaty. So it's just it's really interesting because with Ali, like he thinks that once he replays his cube in like once he broadcasts it, people will know that he's innocent. But it turns out that like no one believes it.
No one cared.
His whole second act arc is to broadcast his cube. And after he does that, Nero just pulls out some expert witnesses to say how this is a forgery and it's fake news, pretty much.
Yeah. And it's similar to how, how black people are viewed in media, right? Like, the media can manipulate facts and manipulate images of black people that are being reported. Make them look more aggressive.
Yeah.
And it's just it's
or
all
just refugees
play.
In general.
Yeah.
And then but during the second act he also meets Kara, who is a like a late main character addition whose mother
was a scientist.
Was a scientist who pretty much invented the Overrider.
Yeah. And, what did you guys think
but
of
she,
Kara?
Her daughter didn't know. She just knew her mom was a scientist.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did you guys think of Kara? Like her introduction, like was it too late in the story or
I don't think it was late. For a while I thought, is this Rhee? Like
because
they were both in the same Zeppelin.
Play, misconnection.
Which I thought that was an interesting, like almost meet. I did think that was a good touch. Kara was okay. I think they could have or she could have kind of teased out that it was the sister a little longer. I think it was really just like a chap, like Rhee had her chapter and then you knew.
Yeah. Well, you know, early on in the book that Princess Jocelyn is alive. Mm-hmm. You just don't expect her to show up in this book, at least.
Two pages later.
Yeah.
Well, not two pages later, but like.
And that was something that I guess wasn't explained, like, why did overwriting her memories save her life?
I mean, it's better to be ignorant than...
Is that why? I mean, the way they made it sound, I'm sure this will be explained like book two or three, but the way they made it sound was like the suppression of the traumatic memories was essential in saving her life.
Maybe.
Or was it just to put her in hiding?
I think it was just to put
her in hiding. I think it was mostly to keep her in hiding.
Yeah, because she like took a DNA pill and like erasing her memories temporarily, like that does protect her.
Because if Sutra knew too that both the princes were alive, I think that maybe the whole idea was that he would come get her at some point, or you know, the old adage, if you're in royal family, you have an heir and the spare. So I think after Rhee was the heir, like a small circle knew that they had a spare.
Yeah, but it seemed like Rhee wasn't qualified to be empress.
Nope.
Because she's like the second daughter and she was never trained to be empress. And it seemed like Jocelyn, because she had more guidance for her future role, she was more qualified to be empress. So,
well, I mean, that's very apparent in how the stories shake out. Like, Kara's characterized as someone who is very proactive, but also very caring and very, you know, aware of like of her surroundings.
Yeah.
Whereas Rhee is single-minded, kind of petty, kind of spoiled,
mm-hmm.
And is making a billion mistakes on her path.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little bit churned off by Kara and Allie's supposed romance. I just thought that came too quickly for me. I was like, you guys just met. Like, why are you crushing on Kara?
As soon as he put his arm around her, I was like, oh, game over. There is no chance of them being platonic at all.
Nope.
I mean, that came like, it wasn't just a few days, though. It was like maybe a couple of weeks at that point, right?
I guess.
No. Like, he realized he was, like, attracted to her, but they didn't actually do anything about it until the end of the book, which was, like, a few weeks later. But I'm talking about, like, the instant where they meet when they're, like, in the hold, or in the,
space whatever, Zeppelin?
Basement of the, yeah.
Oh, I didn't
the realize. Space basement or whatever. And so, like, a guard comes because he hears weird noises and they have to hide. Allie throws his arm around her to, like,
hide
protect her. And then you know, like, again, like I said, game over.
Oh, I didn't. Oh, yeah. I guess I didn't get that.
I was kind of happy that there was very little romance because like the pace of this novel was, I mean, like the first 100 pages, I was like, okay, let's get on with it. Like, mm-hmm. like let's see what happens after the assassination and the framing.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of like speeds at like a breakneck pace, but I was like really glad that no romance was kind of hinted at until the very end. And I was like, oh, it's the very end of the novel. I kind of don't want this.
I didn't mind mm-hmm. it because at least he wasn't like crushing on her the entire second half of the book.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What did you guys think about the ending? Because what is it? Allie and Kara, they go to Nofruma, which is where Rhee started out in the beginning of the novel. And they're going to find Rhee's handler so they can find Rhee. But then they find out the handler is dead because the handler was Veyron. So we kind of go mm-hmm. complete
Were they looking
circle.
For Rhee?
Oh, no, they were looking for Lancer.
They're looking for the contact named Lance. Yeah.
And, you know, Lancer was Veyron and Veyron was killed. Right. So, mm-hmm. like, literally we go full circle.
Right, because both of them were given handlers, right? Rhee and... But, since we know it's a duology, I think it's a good setup for, like, the next half. I'm interested to see where this goes, because you have, like, the two narratives now turn from, like, so now Rhee finally realizes who her real enemy is, and she decides that she will defeat him through politics.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Rhee kind of reminds me of Princess Leia in Star Wars.
Really?
Yeah.
Princess Leia was lot better at her job.
I don't know. I have issues with Princess Leia. I feel like she was also too impulsive. Mm-hmm. And now she's a general, but... So I'm guessing that Rhee will like actually learn from her mistakes and become more competent. That's my hope, at least.
Well, there's a whole scene in the confrontation with Rhee and Nero where he's pretty much lecturing her, like, you did
that
this
was so
to
annoying.
Like, it's like, you're so short-sighted. Do you know how many years it took for me to plan all of this? And don't you know how long you have to wait in order to make a successful war campaign?
Well, also her short-sightedness seems like part of his plan, or he used it to his advantage. Right?
Well, yeah.
She was able to get rid of all his obstacles, pretty much.
Pretty much. Yeah.
I don't know. That whole scene I felt like could have been done better of just like, and now we have 20 pages of the bad guy explaining his great spectacular
plan.
Have
the bad guy monologue.
It was not 20 pages. It was pretty short.
And then the octopus man swoops in and saves the day. It's...
Yeah, that was weirder. I didn't know that, like, she's going to get out of this, but I did not expect it like that.
I'm glad that the governess, like, was the one who planned it all out. She's like, I know my charge is impulsive and fails a lot, so I'm going to go and find the one person who can, like, disguise her and also save her later, because I know she's going to get caught. So I like how the governess planned all of that out.
I just like the image of the fisherman jumping in with a giant harpoon gun, like...
Very cinematic.
Did he jump in or did he tear the roof off of a building with a harpoon gun?
Well, he crashed through. He pretty much, he made a big damn entrance, pretty much.
Is there a favorite scene that you guys have? For me, I really like the scene where Rhee goes into the press junket because it's her first, because she's been so sheltered and because she has like such a naivety to her that she believes that her people, they're equal and people have like people are unbiased and more sympathetic towards Raytons. I mean, it makes sense because she's crushing on Julian, who is part Rayton. Mm-hmm. And when she notices like all of the hate in the room, she says a line. I wrote it down. She says, was there so much hatred in the universe, so much prejudice, even among people who claim to be unbiased? So I highlighted that. Yeah, I really like that scene because it's like her first moment realizing, oh shit, I have a lot of work to do when I'm empress, because there's a lot of...
Well, she's also noticing how all her royal guards suck.
Yeah, that too. She notices that how like poorly her guards treat her own people, and she realizes how privilege plays out in her empire. So that scene really really hit me, because I think everyone after the 2016 election had like a wake up moment, and that was her wake up moment. So I actually really, really like that scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the quotes that I also highlighted wasn't like the overall scene was okay. It's when Allie meets Kara for the first time and they're hiding out in the space bus basement. And he's realizing just how much people hate him and his community and stuff.
Yeah. Like I forgot the exact quote, but there was a line where he realizes that war isn't measured by the number of people killed, it's the number of people who are left behind, people who are orphaned because of the war, or people who are separated from their families because there's not enough space for refugees in like the boat or the ship. So yeah, there are like definitely parts in this book that really hit you with themes of like refugees and war and the cost of war. And it's really cool that all of that could be placed in a sci-fi book, a space opera book.
Yeah. So, I guess we're coming up on the end of our discussion. Anything else you want to mention, Lily?
Not really. Again, I thought it was a good book. She did a really good job world building with, such a large setting of space, but I'm not itching for a sequel. Or itching to read the sequel right away.
I mean, since the sequel's out, I wouldn't mind just continuing on. It was a pretty easy read. Like I was able to breeze through it in like a day. And that's only because I started reading Jade City and that kind of took up a lot of time.
I told you not to do that. I knew you were going to do that. And it's like, oh man, don't juggle more than one book right now.
I can juggle. It's my thing. Juggling and binging. I bought the softcover version of the book that just came out this month. And it comes with a preview of the first two chapters of the next book. And it seems like it sets up the story for, like, I don't know. It at this point, I'm interested enough to, like, there's a momentum, you know, how, like, we just, because I just finished it last night, to, like, want to know what happens next. So I don't know. Maybe I will pick it up.
I'll probably read the sequel. Most likely read the sequel because I am very curious. Overall, I did like reading this book. I really liked the setting. I really liked how there were multiple planets and territories, and how, like, expansive the universe was, and just like themes of colonialism and privilege and colorism and technology and privacy. Mm. Like, there's so many things that are, like, interwoven into the narrative.
Yeah, it's a really good sci-fi plot. I really like also that the characters are allowed to be dumb and have consequences for it.
Yeah, it's very nice to have characters who are flawed and really, like, you know, like, as a reader, you get attached to the characters. And for me, it was the entire time I was like, no, don't do that. Like, don't do that. And, like, and because, like, you are switching between two protagonists, like, like, I don't know. Like, it gave me, like, recover time. Like, especially with, like, chapters with Rhea, I'm like, oh, no, she's going to do this thing. Like, please don't.
Well,
and then the chapter with Allie shows up. I'm like, okay, good. Like, I have, like, a break in between.
Yeah, but
he does something dumb or selfish. Or
I also really liked Allie's character. He's just a cinnamon roll. He's like, it was really nice to have, like, a female character who is, like so focused on revenge and is kind of, like, hard edges, because I feel like we don't see that a lot in sci-fi, at least. And it was really nice to see a male character who is just, like, who just wants to be a good boy. He's a soft boy. He has a good heart, and he just wants to do the right thing, but he's always in situations where he has the wrong timing. And
he's just like, the why is everything happening to me? That's his entire arc. It's like, why is,
like,
this?
While I was reading this book, I was like, oh, protect him.
Like, I did
he's
everything
going
right.
So much stuff.
I did everything right. I joined the army. I became a TV star. And why does everyone hate me?
His character actually reminded me a lot of Zacharias from Sorcerer's Crown. I mean, probably for obvious reasons, but it's. I don't know. I really like this character, and I think the book really was interesting because it switched back and forth between the two POVs.
I mean, I kind of personally felt some schadenfreude for Rhi's plight sometimes, because, like, look what you did. You should feel bad. Same with Allie. Like, look what you did. You killed your best friend. What the hell, man?
Oh, my God. So there's this line.
Oh, my God.
There's this line in the book where she says, oh, I need to compensate for my youth with cunning and strategy. And I just rolled my eyes, and I was
that,
like,
is such a 16-year-old thing to say, though.
I'm just like, you're 16, you've made so many mistakes. It's not gonna happen, at least not for another book. Like,
we totally didn't mention Pavel.
Oh, Pavel, yes.
What, I could not get a mental image of what that damn robot looked like.
I think he's like a small robot, right? Or like,
yeah, he's like a small, like, Roomba.
Yeah.
2 feet tall, and he looks vaguely humanoid, right?
Yeah, he's like C-3PO.
He reminded me of K2SO in terms of, like, his dry sense of humor.
I'm all for robot assistants with, like, dry and witty humor.
Yeah.
I've been seeing that a lot in sci-fi books, and it's kind of a trope now, but I embrace that trope. I like it, so...
Pavel was really cute. I just couldn't get a mental image of
Pavel,
this thing.
Best character. When they lost him, when they were falling down that shaft, like, no!
I know.
Pavel, no!
I like that scene where, like, Pavel lies to, like, mm-hmm. one of the Uniforce
he's like,
soldiers.
Nothing to see here.
and then like Ali, like Ali, he thinks, it's like, oh, he can lie now. Yeah. Wow, I'm so proud of him.
Or like when he was like, worth it.
Worth it, yeah. But yeah, there were a lot of parts in this book that I really liked. I do have some criticism about this book, and that's sometimes the setting seemed overwhelming because there was a lot of planet hopping, and I kind of wish there was like more description so you could like get a handle on the planets a little bit more. But
yeah, I actually didn't mind it as much because it was from the perspective of mostly Ali, and he just thinks every planet is trash, right?
I mean, like, for me to ask, like, oh, I want more description on, like, each planet and, like, their culture, that's asking a little bit too much because this book is actually pretty short and that kind of detail requires, like, 500 pages. Yeah. So,
And it'd be a different type of book.
It would be a different type of book.
Focusing the action was a good move. Yeah. I do agree that, like, you know, it would have been nice to explore the space more. But these are people, these are fugitives on the run, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess that'll do it.
That'll do it. So our final book of 2017 is Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. If you haven't gotten the book now, we've been saying it for the past 2.5 months. You should get it now.
It's a award-winning, Nobel Prize award-winning novel. Right?
No, Nobel Prize winning author.
Oh.
The book wasn't awarded the Nobel Prize.
I thought it was for the, but he was
it's awarded for the author.
For the book.
No. Right? No. Okay. No, author. Lifetime of books. Right.
This is our first Nobel Prize winning author. Is it our first?
No, I don't know. Maybe. It's really late, you guys. But yeah, like December's book is Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. Yeah. And our January book, because we are trying to give people a head notice, is Pachinko by Minjin Lee.
Oh.
That book has been
on sale.
Yeah, I think it's still on sale. The paperback came out.
That's definitely been on my to-read list. Yeah.
It's been on my bookshelf for the past 1.5 years, and I just haven't cracked it open. So now it's a good incentive to read it.
So there you have it. That is our discussion of Empress of a Thousand Skies by Rhoda Beleza. The sequel, Blood of a Thousand Stars, is out now as well. So if you guys can't wait to see what happens to Ali, Kara, and Ree, and Pavel, of course, check it out in your local bookstore.
Anyway, Lily, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Lily, for joining us.
Me.
If people
want to
find your writing, where can they go?
I'm really active on Twitter, so I'm Lily_Rugo, R-U-G-O. And then, like, all of my links are there. Also, if you Google This Bitch Blog, that's also me.
She has an excellent post about Sherlock Holmes, like, about the femme fatale characters. And
someone read it. Thank you.
I read everything you write. What are you talking about?
Oh my God. Thank you so much.
As always, you can follow our book club by joining our Goodreads group. We have a very active forum where you can talk about the latest news about books from Asian American authors. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, where we're very active. Rira does a really great job with our social media presence, and
I've been kind of stepping back from it because 2017 has just drained all of my energy. And you know, going on Twitter used to be fun. Now it's just exhausting.
It is.
I think, you know what we need to do? Just focus on the good and like,
what
just
do you
like,
mean,
ignore,
like focus on the good? Like,
ignore
I feel like
the shitty
every
stuff.
Time I go on Twitter, people are retweeting all the racist stuff that's been happening in publishing. Like when the whole Marvel news broke, that was my entire Twitter feed for like a day and a half. And I was like, I need a break. I need a break from 2017.
Well, good news.
Honestly,
it's almost ending
over. Yeah. Thanks again for listening to Books and Boba. We'll see you next time.
And keep reading.
Keep reading. Thanks, Vera. This episode of Books and Boba was hosted by Marvin Yue, Rira Yu, and Lily Rugo, and edited by Marvin Yue. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of podcasts featuring unique voices from the Asian American community. If you like Books and Boba, please check out one of the other great shows in the collective, such as the Korean Drama Podcast. The Korean Drama Podcast is a rewatch podcast by people who don't really watch Korean dramas. They just wrapped up their first season rewatching the seminal K-drama series, Boys Over Flowers. You can find the Korean Drama Podcast and the other great programs of the Potluck Collective by going to the website podcastpotluck.com.